We were in the middle of discussing Daniel chapter 8, the end of the last hour. Just to briefly refresh your mind, you have a vision there described in the first part of the chapter, which involves this ram with two horns, the goat with a great horn, and then the four notable ones that arise out of that, and then the little horn which grew exceedingly great out of one of the parts of those four noble ones, verses 9 to 12. You have that vision in 1 to 14, the interpretation of the vision in 20 to 27. We were working our way down through that. I think right at the end of the hour, I had been talking about Antiochus Epiphanes in connection with the statement in verse 9 that out of one of them, that is, the them referring back to verse 8, the four notable ones that came up to the four winds of heaven, the four parts of Alexander's kingdom, out of one of them came forth a little horn that grew exceedingly great. And then you look over at 23 and 24, and you read in the latter time of their kingdom, and you notice again that the reference goes back to the end of 22, the four kingdoms that shall stand up out of the nation, but not his power. That is, not in Alexander's power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, verse 23, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. So you have this little horn who is described as a king of fierce countenance, understanding dark sentences, shall stand up. His power shall be mighty, and so forth. And I mentioned that that seems clearly to be a picture of Antiochus Epiphanes, who was this Seleucid ruler, attacked the Ptolemaic kingdom in Egypt, but was forced to withdraw from Egypt by the Roman forces that had been sent to try to limit the growth of the Seleucid power. And then he vented his wrath in his return from Egypt on Jerusalem and desecrated the temple, polluted the altar. And that action seems to be sort of cryptically referred to, you see, in verse 11. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. That's verse 11 has, I'll come back to that, has some translation problems. But I say it seems that that action against the temple seems to be in view there. That is described in more detail in chapter 11, verse 30 and following. Now, we'll look at 11 later, but if you go to chapter 11 and look at verse 30. You read, for the ships of Kittim shall come against him. Ships of Kittim there, undoubtedly the Roman forces. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with those who forsake the Holy Covenant, and forces shall stand on his part. And they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be helped with a little help, but many shall cling to them with flatteries, and some of them of understanding shall fall to test them, to purge, and so forth. So it seems that that same incident that here is just referred to in a verse is expanded upon in chapter 11 in more detail, again referring to Antiochus. So verses 23 through 25 seem to be a descriptive of this king of fierce countenance, and to fit adequately what we know of the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, when we go back to to verses 9 through 11. I mentioned I want to make a few comments on them. I'm reading from the King James. The NIV is a bit different. But King James reads, "Out of one of them came forth a little horn, which grew exceedingly great, toward the south, toward the east, toward the pleasant land." Pleasant land being Israel. "And it grew great even to the host of heaven." Now, what's the host of heaven? Most commentators feel that that is a figurative way of describing godly people, believers. So this little horn grows great even to this host of heaven, and it cast down some of the hosts. In other words, some of the godly people are cast to the ground, and of the stars to the ground, and stamped upon them. In other words, you know, with Abraham even, you had God telling Abraham that your seed shall be as the stars of heaven. And you do have that kind of symbolism used of people. And it seems here that in 10, that's representative of the godly people that are cast to the ground and stamped on by this horn, that is, by Antiochus. "Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host." Now, who is the prince of the host? Prince of the host must be God himself, the ruler of the godly people, the prince of the host. So he magnified himself even to God. And then the King James says, "By him the daily sacrifice was taken away." In the Hebrew, that's memenu. I think it's better translated, "And from him the daily sacrifice was taken away." That is, from God, the daily sacrifice is taken away by Antiochus. But from him, that is, from God, the daily sacrifice was taken away. And the place of his sanctuary, that is, God's sanctuary, was cast down. So it seems that that's the way 11 is to be understood. 12 says, "And a host was given to him." Again, referring to godly people. The King James says a host was given him against the daily sacrifice. I think it's better translated with the daily sacrifice, by reason of transgression. And it cast down the truth to the ground and continued and prospered. Question.
Which
in 12?
Because of the value of most of the saints and the daily sacrifice.
Let me see here. Because of rebellion, the host of the saints. Yeah, that's similar to what I was suggesting with the modification of the King James. Because of rebellion, the host of the saints and the daily sacrifice given over to it. In other words, there were godly people as well as this daily sacrifice that come into the power of this horn, namely Antiochus, because they rebelled against him. Because they didn't submit to him. Because they didn't submit to him. And it, that is this horn, namely Antiochus, see that it can kind of distort the idea you're talking about an individual, but if you're talking in the context of the horn and represents an individual, it prospered in everything it did, that is Antiochus, and truth was thrown to the ground. When you get on to verses 13 and 14, you have another thing that's caused a fair amount of discussion. And that is this. You read, "Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint who spoke, How long shall the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression or abomination of desolation give both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? And he said unto me, Under 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." And the thing that's caused the discussion is that reference to 2,300 days. 2,300 days. I notice here, I do have in your citation some comments on verse 12. I don't think I'm going to take the time to read all that, but if you look at page 37 of your citations, going back for a minute before we come in on that 2300 days, if you look at page 37 of your citations, that first paragraph is Walvoord's comments on verse 12. It's pretty much what I just reviewed with you. And then if you go over to page 39, under E.J. Young, the first paragraph, I will read that for you. This is about verse 12. The language of the text is difficult, but I follow Maurer, Habernick, Kyle, and von Langerke and others in adopting the reading, and a host was given up together with the daily sacrifice because of transgression. Thus, and here's his paraphrase, and host, that is, many of the Israelites, on account of transgression, apostasy from God. Now, see, there he would have apostasy from God, not rebellion against Antiochus, but which he may, that may be a better way to read it. But a host, many Israelites, on account of transgression, i.e. apostasy from God, will be given up, delivered up in transgression, together with, that is, thereon at the same time, the continual sacrifice. But when you go on to 12 and 13 to get to that 2300 days, follow on through here with Young. Young mentions two interpretations. The next paragraph there on page 39 of your citations. One interpretation, it means, correct that from 150 to 1150. It means 1150 days. In other words, half the 2300. That's one view. The logic behind that is this. This interpretation, as far as I know, was first set forth by Ephraim of Syria, although it appears to have been held also by Hippolytus. Those who adopt it argue that the prophecy is related to the sacrifice of the continual, that is, the morning and evening sacrifices. 2,300 such sacrifices, therefore, will be offered on 1,150 days, one in the morning, one in the evening. Many also find support for this position in an appeal to 725, which they assert means 3.5 years. And the 1150 days, they say, is nearly equivalent to the 3.5 years. But it is obvious that the 1150 days do not equal 3.5 years, not in an exact way, even when those years be regarded as comprising only 360 days or a total of 1260 days. This discrepancy is, of course, recognized in Zuckler, possibly the ablest advocate of this view, thinks the 1150 days represent a designed narrowing of the period. But that's one view, that this situation that's described here is going to last for 1150 days. The second view is may mean 2300 days. This interpretation appears in the Greek version, Jerome, most Protestant expositors, authorized version, appears to be correct. There's no exegetical support for the position that the phrase evening morning means that the evenings and mornings are to be counted separately. Thus, 1150 evenings, 1150 days. As Kyle correctly argues, a Hebrew reader could not possibly understand the period 23 evenings, mornings of 2300 half days or 1150 whole days, because evening and morning at the creation constituted not the half but the whole day. Hence, we must understand the phrase as 2300 days. Now, as far as, go over to page 40, what are the 2300 days then? If that's the preferred reading, I'd be inclined to think it is. 2300 days, approximately 171 BC to 165 BC, the period of Antiochus's abominations. If you look at page 37, or, wait a minute. Page 37, yeah, the second paragraph is on this question from Walvoord. You might note there in your margin that this is on verse 14, the second paragraph on page 37. Innumerable explanations have been attempted to make the 2300 days coincide with the history of Antiochus. The terminus ad quem of the 2300 days is taken by most expositors as 164, when Antiochus died during a military campaign in Media. This permitted the purging of the sanctuary, the return to Jewish worship. Figuring from this date backward, 2300 days would fix the beginning time at 171. In that year, Onias III, the legitimate high priest, was murdered, and a pseudo line of priests assumed power. This would give adequate fulfillment in the time for the 2300 days to elapse at the time of the death of Antiochus. The actual desecration of the temple, however, did not occur until December 25th, 167, when the sacrifices in the temple were forcibly caused to cease and a Greek altar erected in the temple. The actual desecration of the temple lasted only about 3 years. During this period, Antiochus issued coins with the title Epiphanes, which claimed that he manifested divine honors, which showed him as beardless, wearing a diadem. Taking all the evidence into consideration, the best conclusion is that the 2300 days of Daniel are fulfilled in the period from 171 B.C., culminating in the death of Antiochus in 164. Alternate theories produce more problems than they solve. So, it seems that chapter 8, then, gives this picture of the flow of history from the time of the Babylonian period up to the time of the rise of Antiochus Epiphanes and the persecutions that were experienced under the time of his rule. Now, having said that, if the critical approach to the book of Daniel is right, then you see their argument is that the writer was someone who lived in the time of Antiochus, was observing these things going on, and then to encourage the people that God was with them, he is predicting that Antiochus is soon to be overthrown. And that's the way the critics make their case. And then they argue that the stories in chapters 1 to 6, those narratives, are the creation of this writer. They're not really historical. There may be some ideas in them that have some historical validity, but they're more fictional than historical. And it's a human book. That's the critical case. If the critical case is not true, and certainly the way you view Scripture has a lot to do with whether you're willing to even entertain the idea of the critical view. But if Daniel wrote the book, and it's dated back in the time of the Babylonian period, then clearly this is a divinely inspired prediction of the flow of history up to the time of Antiochus. It's a remarkable prophecy because of the detail to which it describes the arise of this individual, Antiochus. But in this case, this is an authentic, predictive prophecy. It's not some sort of fraudulent one representing itself as coming from Daniel, but actually coming from someone who was observing the very things that it describes. Now, there's one further question that I want to bring up. We haven't really touched much on yet, touched on it a bit. And that's the question, is this king of fierce countenance, this little horn in Daniel chapter 8, is this a reference to Antiochus or is it a reference to Antichrist? Is it a reference to Antiochus or is it a reference to Antichrist? Or, make another option, is it a double reference? Are both of them here in some way? Some have raised questions about certain phrases, particularly in 23 to 25, as to whether or not they really apply to Antiochus. Seems to me that all of them can adequately be related to Antiochus. But some have raised questions about that. But then you can ask the question, is it Antiochus or is it Antichrist or is it both? And those kinds of questions have often been discussed. If you look at the top page 38, in Walvoord's commentary on Daniel, he proposes four approaches to this question. Notice top 38. He says, although a great deal of variation is found in details of interpretation, four major views emerge. One, the historical view, that all of Daniel 8 has been fulfilled. Two, the futuristic view, the idea that it's entirely future. In other words, one, the historical view would be it's Antiochus, it's been fulfilled. It's all in the past. It's future to the time of Daniel, but it's all in the past to us. Two, the futuristic view, the idea it's entirely future. That is, none of this was fulfilled in Antiochus. It's all speaking of the Antichrist. It's yet to be fulfilled. Thirdly, the view based upon the principle of dual fulfillment of prophecy, Daniel 8 is intentionally a prophetic reference both to Antiochus, now fulfilled, and to the end of the age, and the final world ruler who persecutes Israel before the second advent. And then fourthly, the view that the passage is prophecy, historically fulfilled, namely in Antiochus, but intentionally typical of similar events and personages at the end of the age. So, see, historical view, futuristic view, dual fulfillment, typical view would be the four options that he discusses. Now, to follow on with those comments of Walvoord, you notice the next paragraph, which relates to the first view. He says, principal difficulty with the purely historical view, he has questions about it, saying that this is purely historical, that it refers to Antiochus. He says, principal difficulty with purely historical view is that it provides no satisfactory explanation of the expression, the time of the end. Remember, I mentioned that last class hour, at the end of verse 17. At the time of the end shall be the vision. And at the end of verse 19, in the last end of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be. He doesn't feel that expression is done justice if you say it's referring to Antiochus. The other references in the book of Daniel, which use it as the end of the time of the Gentiles and certain details that are given in the interpretation of the vision, those are reasons he feels that the purely historical view is not satisfactory. The second view, the totally future view, there are very few that hold to that view. I mean, there's too much linkage in the context to the Greek kingdom, to the Seleucid division of that kingdom and the rise of Antiochus. So that's not really a prominent view. But the third and the fourth certainly do find a fair number of advocates, and particularly the third one. The third one is the dual fulfillment view. The next paragraph there, Walvoord's comments on that. He says, in view of the problems of a purely historical fulfillment on the one hand or a purely futuristic fulfillment on the other, many expositors have been intrigued with the possibility of a dual fulfillment. That is, that a prophecy fulfilled in part in the past is a foreshadowing of a future event which will completely fulfill the passage. Variations exist in this approach, with some taking the entire passage as having dual fulfillment, and others taking Daniel 8:1-14 as historically fulfilled, that is, the vision itself, you see, and Daniel 8:15-17 as having dual fulfillment. 15-17 is where it speaks of the time of the end. This latter view was popularized by the Scofield Reference Bible. Both the 1917-1967 edition interpret chapter 8 as being fulfilled historically in Antiochus, but prophetically, beginning with verse 17, as being fulfilled at the end of the age with the second advent. Let me just read you a couple statements from the old Scofield. That's the 1917 edition. There's a note on verse 9 where it speaks of the little horn. And the note says, the little horn here is a prophecy fulfilled in Antiochus Epiphanes. But then, further down, it says, verses 24 and 25, see, 24 and 25 give the interpretation of the vision, and the note says, verses 24 and 25 go beyond Antiochus and evidently refer to the little horn of Daniel 7. Now, the little horn of Daniel 7 seems clearly to be the Antichrist. Both Antiochus, it says then, and the beast, but the beast preeminently are viewed in verses 24 and 25. So there you get the dual fulfillment. Both Antiochus and the beast but the beast preeminently. On verses 10 to 14, the old Scofield says, historically, this was fulfilled in and by Antiochus. But, in a more intense and final sense, Antiochus but adumbrates the awful blasphemy of the little horn of Daniel 7 and various other references. In Daniel 8, the actions of both little horns blend. The actions of both horns blend. You see, you can't read it other than that these statements have double reference. They're talking at the same time about Antiochus and about the Antichrist. And then when it comes to that expression at the time of the end, at the end of verse 17, the note says two ends are in view. Two ends are in view. One, historically the end of the third or Grecian Empire of Alexander, out of one of the divisions of which the little horn of verse 9 arose. That's one end. Two, prophetically, the end of the times of the Gentiles, when the little horn of Daniel 7 will arise. You really have a pretty clear example of dual fulfillment in the Scofield notes. In the more recent revised Scofield, that's been toned down a bit, but that note I just read you really reads the same. This Scofield says of that phrase at the end of verse 17, two ends seem to be in view here. Historically, the end of the Third Empire. Prophetically, the end of the times of the Gentiles. So that's that third view, dual fulfillment. Notice Walvoord's next statement is, many premillennial writers follow this interpretation. A careful scrutiny of these many points will justify the conclusion that it is possible to explain all these elements as fulfilled historically in Antiochus Epiphanes. He's talking about verses 23 through 25 there. Most of the factors are obvious, and the principal difficulty is occasioned by the expression in the latter time of their kingdom, and in the statement, he shall stand up against the prince of princes. Antiochus Epiphanes, of course, did arise in the latter time of the Syrian kingdom. However, the use of other terms, such as the end in verse Old Testament period of God's judgment against his people in the Old Testament period, it doesn't necessarily mean eschatological end time. Taken as a whole, the principal problem of the passage, when interpreted as prophecy fulfilled completely in Antiochus, is the allusions to the end of the age. See, he keeps coming back to that. These are hard to understand as relating to Antiochus in view of the larger picture of Daniel 7, which concludes with the second advent of Christ. And he goes further to suggest that both are in view. Top page 39, he says it may be concluded that this difficult passage apparently goes beyond that which is historically fulfilled in Antiochus to foreshadow a future personage often identified as world ruler of the end time. In many respects, this ruler carries on a persecution of Israel and desecration of the temple, similar to what was accomplished historically by Antiochus. This interpretation of the vision may be regarded as an illustration of double fulfillment of prophecy, or, and here's, you see, the alternative here, to me, is much more attractive. And it seems that Walvoord's stress is more on dual fulfillment than on this alternative. But you notice he says, or, using Antiochus as a type, the interpretation may go on to reveal additional facts which go beyond the type in describing the ultimate king who will oppose Israel in the last days. He indeed will be broken without hands at the time of the second advent of Christ. It's the same sort of question we discussed earlier. I forgot in what respect. But when we were discussing first order, the thing of dual fulfillment. In other words, here's a prophecy, and there's specific things in that prophecy detailed. And it seems to me that it's pointing forward then to fulfillment of those specific details at some point in the future. And it seems to me with this prophecy, you've got the prophecy spoken by Daniel. He's looking forward to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. And when you look at the content of what he says, it's fulfilled in Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, what Walvoord is saying, and what clearly the Scofield Bible is saying, is that it's more like this.
And it's speaking at the same time in fact of Epiphanies and of the Antichrist.
You have a dual fulfillment, a multiple sense. Now, the alternative, that typical view, which to me is much more attractive, which would say, yes, it's speaking of Antiochus, but Antiochus as a person typifies the Antichrist, and in that sense, it points forward to the Antichrist. I don't think there's any doubt that Antiochus is a type of the Antichrist. And it seems to me that that's to be preferred. He mentions that view. He seems to prefer the dual fulfillment. And then when he talks about this view, notice the way he words it. It's unfortunate. At the end of that paragraph, top of page 39, he says, this interpretation of the vision may be regarded as an illustration of double fulfillment of prophecy, or using Antiochus as a type. Fine. The interpretation may go on, but then to reveal additional facts which go beyond the type. I don't think it reveals additional facts that go beyond the type. There you're back into the double fulfillment thing, if you're going to say that. In describing the ultimate king who will oppose Israel in the last days. So it seems to me that even this typical view and the way he has formulated it here is somewhat problematic. I don't see that you need to say that there's any additional facts that go beyond the type.
First of all, would you imply that there's not only those two, that there would be whatever rulers characterize persecution of believers and the other things there, they would fit it, and so it would be dual, it would be multiple in a sense. And how is this different from a dual fulfillment? The type of dual fulfillment in this case seems very, very close.
Well, except that you have, of a specific statement, you have a single sense and a single fulfillment. If you take a statement, say, say verse 11, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away. You'd say that is talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, and when he did that in the temple in Jerusalem, that was its fulfillment, period. There is no other fulfillment. But Antiochus as an individual and in many of his specific acts is foreshadowing the coming of another individual in the future who will do similar things, but will be a more intense, with heightened fulfillment, you move progress of redemptive history from a lower to a higher plane. So when the Antichrist comes, presumably he's going to do things that are similar, but even worse. He'll be a more complete embodiment of the same basic principle or truth. And I'm not sure, you say, well, it could be typical of many things in between. It's possible.
Progression.
It's possible. I'd say that we have revelation about the coming of the Antichrist. We know such an individual is on the scene. We don't know about, although John does say there will be many Antichrists. There are other people who so in that sense, maybe you could say that this fellow does have more than one antitype along the progression of redemptive history. I hadn't really thought about that, but maybe you could. I mean, if you take the, Voss works with that principle and uses the tabernacle as an illustration. You have the tabernacle, the dwelling of God with man. In antitype, the highest fulfillment of that is the new heaven and new earth, where God is dwelling with his people in the fullest and complete sense. But you find fulfillment in the incarnation of Christ. You find fulfillment in the church, the individual believer. There's sort of a progression of antitypes in which that principle is realized in the progression of redemptive history. But you see, that still avoids multiple sense or multiple meaning. These words have one sense and one meaning. But it seems the way I understand Scripture, certain individuals, people, certain places, certain events, certain institutions,
things of that sort can symbolize some truth. And in so symbolizing that truth, can become typical of a later realization of that same truth.
So the difference would be, Daniel was referring to, in fact, his figures, but when we see him in history, we see
what's the point?
So
that's
it's not
point.
Like he's properly
that's right.
The
that's
other.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, this idea of a double fulfillment problem has a problem, I think, in Jack. And in Antichrist here, the same one as the small horn in chapter 7, is that correct? Which comes out of the fourth kingdom, whereas in Titus Epiphanes comes out of the third kingdom, isn't that right?
Well, I wouldn't make much of the order of, you mean the four divisions of Alexander's empire?
No, you have four major kingdoms.
Oh, all right, I see what you're saying.
Okay,
yeah.
So here he's coming out of the Greek kingdom, and Titus Epiphanes is coming out of the Roman one. So if you're going to talk double fulfillment, somehow you have to figure out how this one that is in the passage is coming out of the Greek one, because you said it's come out of the Roman one, right?
Very, very severe objection.
Yes.
You're right, because this is clearly the Greek kingdom. I mean, the antecedent of verse 9, the little horn out of one of them, goes back to the four notable ones that come out of the Greek kingdom, not out of the Roman kingdom.
The Greek kingdom.
That's right.
Of course, you take the Antichrist, you have to come out of the Roman kingdom.
That's right.
They say, well, one king sort of blends into another one.
Yeah. I don't. The force of the antecedent between verse 9 going back to verse 8 and verse 23 going back to verse 22. In both cases, you have out of one of them and in the latter time of their kingdom, the antecedent is the four parts of the Greek kingdom. And how you can move from that to the Antichrist or the Romans is very problematic. Yeah.
When you look at the psychological aspects of some of the Old Testament figures like characters, do we need to have biblical warrant, I guess, to apologize?
There's difference of view on that. Some people say only legitimate type is one that is identified as such by some other scripture. My own view is that's too narrow. I think some have gone to that view because of the abuse of typology and finding types all over very easily. Becomes something that makes interpretation, it seems, many times suspect. I, though, think that Voss's idea that if you use symbolism as a gateway to typology and you keep the same truth, whatever is the truth being symbolized, the same truth, if it reappears at a later point in redemptive history, that symbol can be the gateway to typology if you keep the same truth in the line of progression of redemptive history. I think that is a guard against abuse and falling into allegorical kinds of uses of typology. But I think even with that kind of a safeguard, you have to be very careful that you do keep the same truth. So the truth that appears here, it's got to be the same truth in the progression of redemptive history at a later stage that reappears. And if you find that, I don't see any reason why we shouldn't say that the one is anticipating the later one and is a type of that.
So is the reason we're postulating typology to answer problems?
I wouldn't say it's to fit verse 17, because in my view, 17 can adequately be understood as the end of the Old Testament period. I don't think it's eschatological end. I'd say the only reason that the typology thing comes in here is that it does seem generally that Antiochus embodies a personification of evil that is, at the end of history, going to reappear in an even more intense stage at the time of the Antichrist. This is one of the worst persecutions of God's people, certainly in the Old Testament period. And you have an individual that does certain things here to God's people that in other passages that speak of the Antichrist seems like he's going to do similar things. So it seems like an anticipation of that. Well, I guess we could spend more time discussing this, but maybe we better push ahead. We got a long way to go in Daniel. Daniel is a complex book. Yes?
How does that refer to the Romans? Where is the, what is it?
How does that what?
How does that refer to the Roman fleet? Like, where is the king?
Many think it's Cyprus. It's somewhat obscure. There's some obscurity in that, but many think that Kittim is a reference to Cyprus.
Which is under Roman control.
Yeah. We'll look at 11 later in a little more detail. I might say on that phrase, the time of the end, I didn't mention this before. That phrase also occurs in chapter 11. Look at verse 27. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief. They shall speak lies of one table, but it shall not prosper. For yet the end shall be at the appointed time. The end there is also clearly not eschatological. As well as in verse 35. And some of them of understanding shall fall to test them, to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. And again, the time of the end there, it's back in its context of the activities of Antiochus. So it's not eschatological in 11, 27, and 35. Okay, let's go on to 2 on your outline. 2 is a question of basic approach to the book of Daniel. Before going further, I thought I'd make some comments about basic approaches. There are many variations of approach to the interpretation of Daniel, but I think most of them can be reduced to 3 main categories. And I think it's helpful to have those basic categories of approach in mind as we look further at some of these prophecies and to understand where each is coming from. So let me mention 3 approaches. The first is the critical approach. We've already talked about that. But again, just briefly, that's the viewpoint the book was written in the time of Antiochus. The view, of course, entails assumptions that reflect negatively on the authenticity of the book, as far as it really being prophecy, as well as its historical reliability, because the advocates of that view suggest that the person who wrote it wasn't too clear on his history. A good illustration of that approach is this book in the Old Testament library, Daniel, by Norman Porteous. It's on your bibliography. You ever want to look at sort of a representative commentary of that viewpoint? Look at your citations, page 40. I just have a paragraph there or two. It gives you the essence, I think, from Porteous of the approach. Notice he says, the linguistic evidence, the fact that the visions reveal a vague knowledge of the Babylonian-Persian period, an increasingly accurate knowledge of the Greek period, up to and including the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes, with the exception of the closing events of that reign, suggests a date for the book shortly before 164. The only element, see, he says, of genuine prophecy relates to the anticipated death of Antiochus and the expected intervention of God in the establishment of his kingdom. Everything else that is, quote, revealed to Daniel is history viewed in retrospect, either in symbol
or as interpreted to Daniel, or in one case, by Daniel the heathen king. The whole book, this is from page 20, as we have it, belongs to the few years, 167 to 164, or possibly 169 to 164, but it must have been completed before the rededication of the temple by Judas Maccabeus, the death of Antiochus. That the book cannot have been written in the exilic age is proved by the author's vague acquaintance with the Babylonian early Persian period, his actual inaccuracies, by the character of both the Hebrew and the Aramaic in which it is composed. There's nothing inconsistent with their being of the second century. The presence of Greek words points to an age after the conquest of Alexander. You know, we discussed these things. By the literary references to the book, which give no support to an early date for its composition, by its position in the canon, by the character of its theology and angelology. So that, in essence, is the critical view. And in their view, Antiochus Epiphanes is the primary subject of the book. And it was written to people who suffered during his rule. The writer didn't really know what was going to happen in the future. But he expected divine intervention to end this persecution of Antiochus. All right, that's first view, critical view. Second view. I'll call this an orthodox view, but a view which finds its stress, or primary stress of the book, in the prophetic sections on the first coming of Christ. An orthodox view which finds the primary stress of the prophetic sections on the first coming of Christ. It's hard to give a label to this view and to the next one. But I would say generally, this is the view of those who hold to an amillennial eschatological position. They will find stress on the first advent of Christ. Not exclusively so. That is, they wouldn't say there's no picture of the second coming of Christ and of events associated with it. But the stress is on the first advent. Now, example of that position is E.B. Cusey. You look at page 6 of your bibliography under 2b2, Cusey, Daniel the Prophet, late 1800s. Cusey wrote, while these critical views were initially being propounded, he opposed them. He does a good job of arguing for the authenticity of the book. But then he tries to show that the book focuses on the birth of Christ and that the basic message is to show that at the time of the coming of Christ during the Roman period, God's kingdom will be established. So that, for example, in chapter 2, when you have that image with the head of gold and the four parts, and that stone is cut without hands, it smites the image. That's the first advent of Christ. And it's the beginning of the spread of the gospel, which destroys the world empire, as it were. Now, a more recent advocate of this view would be E.J. Young. His book is also there under 2b2, Prophecy of Daniel Commentary. Young also goes rather thoroughly and carefully into questions of authorship, authenticity, historical background, concludes the critical arguments are not convincing, and that the book was written in the days of Nebuchadnezzar by Daniel. But when you come to this matter of interpretation of many of these visions and prophecies, Young sees the fourth empire is the Roman Empire, it's not the Greek, as the critical scholars say. But he says it's not a reestablishment of the Roman Empire. It's the Roman Empire in its original form. And therefore, when the stone cut without hands hits the feet of the image, that is Christ. being born in Bethlehem. And it's through his life and death that the Roman Empire is destroyed. It's the way he argues. Look at page 40 and 41 of your citations. Young says there are two things he is opposing in his commentary. At the bottom of page 40. It says, present work, this is taken from page 5. It says, present work is designed to serve the needs not only of the minister and trained Bible student, but also of the average educated reader of Holy Scripture. It aims above all to present a clear and positive exposition of the prophecy. In order to accomplish such an end, it has been necessary to refute two common interpretations. Top page 41. On the one hand, the so-called critical position of the date and authorship of Daniel must be answered if the true view is to be established. So that's one of his purposes, to refute the critical view. As I mentioned, he does a pretty good job of that. But then the second thing, he says another interpretation, which is very widely held today, although maintaining the genuineness of the book, nevertheless interprets the prophecies in an extremely unwarranted manner by referring the fulfillment of many of them to an alleged period of 7 years, which is supposed to follow the second advent of the Lord. Those who espouse this position are sincere and zealous Christians, and it is only with hesitation that one writes against them. The present author hopes that advocates of this school of thought who study his commentary will understand the spirit in which he has discussed their views and will at least give serious consideration to the interpretation here advanced. So, you see, those that find a great deal of stress on the second advent of Christ, and particularly on this 7-year period connected with the second advent of Christ, he feels this is an extremely unwarranted way to interpret the prophecies. The next paragraph, which comes from page 75, identifies this second view that he is opposing more specifically. He says, in recent times, another interpretation has been making its appearance. This interpretation is known generally as dispensationalism. It is to the effect that the fourth monarchy represents not only the historical Roman Empire, but a revived Roman Empire, which will come to an end by a sudden catastrophic judgment, after which the kingdom of God, the millennium of Revelation 20, will be set up. The destruction of the Gentile world power, according to this view, occurs not at the first coming of Christ, but at his second advent. So, his commentary, as he mentions in his preface, is set out to refute to what he views as erroneous approaches to the interpretation of Daniel. One, the critical view, the other, what he calls the dispensational view. But the stress is on the first advent of Christ. A third view, also difficult to give a label, but I'll describe it this way. A third view finds the focus of the book to be primarily on Antiochus Epiphanes and the persecution under him, and on divine intervention in human affairs at the end times when God's kingdom will be established. Finds this focus or stress to be primarily on Antiochus Epiphanes and on divine intervention in human affairs at the end times when God's kingdom will be established. So, you see, with this third view, contrast with the other two, the first one was the stresses Antiochus Epiphanes alone. Second one is Antiochus Epiphanes may be in view and there may be something about the second advent of Christ, but the stress is first advent of Christ. This third view, the stress is more on the time of Antiochus and on the end time. It's hard to give a view. Hard to give a title or a name. It's an orthodox view. And this third view does not find a great deal of stress on the first advent of Christ, you see. But the stress is on Antiochus and Christ's second coming, end time. Now, I'd say with this approach, there are probably more books written taking slightly different interpretations than in the other two combined. I think that the reason for that is, you see, with the stress on the second coming of Christ, that means you're dealing in many cases with things that as of yet have not been fulfilled. And there, the possibilities are certainly much greater for difference in how this thing is ultimately going to unfold and be fulfilled. There are some in this third category that try almost try to almost get rid of Antiochus altogether. So the distress then shifts almost entirely to the end time. Second advent of Christ, the Antichrist. Or somebody like, see, we've been looking at Walbert here, may say, well, Antiochus is here, but it's kind of merged into the stress on the Antichrist. I don't think that kind of emphasis really does justice to the content of the book. I think that perhaps there's some reaction at work, because the critics put so much stress, you see, on Antiochus. I think certain fundamental scholars feel if they find Antiochus there, we better find something else. We'll be conceding too much. But I think you have to go with, you know, particularly to me, a chapter like chapter 8 is clearly talking about Antiochus. Chapter 11, it seems to me, at least with a good portion of chapter 11, is clearly talking about Antiochus. Now, at some point, I think in 11, you do move to the Antichrist. We'll discuss that. But I think it's hard to really study the book without being aware of these basic approaches. Question that might be asked here, and we'll come back to this later, concerns the matter of time gaps. Young objects.